Hello and welcome to News Roast. I'm Jolyon Rubinstein.
I'm Hayden Prowse.
And this is Three Courses of Conversation.
Yes.
Hayden, if people have never listened to this podcast before, what is it? What's it about?
It's kind of like an amuse-bouche. You know how Tim Spicer eats his chewing gum and then swallows it?
I don't know.
The American
Tim Spicer?
Yeah. He's got him right, and then he just sweat. That's what this is.
Isn't that actually just Melissa McCartney?
No. He actually swallows his chewing gum. Do you not know about that?
Does he actually do that?
There was a statement where to Time magazine or something. He's like, I've been swallowing chewing gum three times a day for years.
That is a bad flex. I was told that's going to stay in your gut for 7 years.
It does. Yeah. But you know how when you eat a Hubba Bubba and you really, really want to swallow it, but you can't.
Yeah.
You know you can't.
Yeah.
That's what this podcast.
But how is that anything like this podcast?
Interesting
fact, but I would more say that this podcast is what we're doing is giving some middle class bants and sort of actually unashamed middle class bants to give you little tidbits, little facts that you can go and give like in a job interview or when you're meeting like your girlfriend's dad for the first time or like, you know, like when
can I just say any cool podcast that starts within the first 30 seconds using the phrase middle class
hashtag
bants,
middle class
you've
bants.
Lost about 1,000 listeners. You're like one of those middle aged guys that at 45 years old starts wearing lycra and cycling on a Saturday.
What's wrong
and
with
he's
that?
Okay with that, but
what's
no one fucking else is.
I'll just do that, it'd be fine.
You just don't want to be stuck behind one.
Well, at that, again, we're getting better. I mean, this is only the fourth podcast we've done.
Let's introduce our guest.
I am absolutely over the blooming moon.
I'm more over the moon, actually.
We're both
equally or more over the moon.
To be joined by multi-talented, and I'll do this in reverse order, children's novelist, actor, stand-up comedian, writer, production company owner.
Chill out, mate. Fucking hell.
Jesus Christ.
This is a bit much.
We are joined by Doc Brown.
Mate,
thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
It's a pleasure, man. Hey, what do you call four white middle-class men in a room?
This is not a yoga studio joke.
A podcast.
That's really good.
Mate, that is some... Well, look, I mean, we're just getting into it now. I mean, fair enough. I mean...
Yeah. Can I say the reason I'm excited to have Doc Brown is because I've been a fan of his since way back when he was a rapper.
Back in
and
the day.
And I used to, when I was at Brighton, like every other, again, middle class kid, I was just super into UK hip hop. And we used to put on nights in Brighton. Yeah. I think you even performed at one of the nights. Tell us about that. How did you first start doing that? What was your.
Rap?
Yeah, what was your road into
I guess just school, where most rappers start, you know. I was always into rap and indie music, but I never really felt like I had the sort of the credentials to be a rapper. But I'd always just write my little rhymes and keep them to myself. First couple of years, nobody knew I wrote rhymes at all. And then, you know, I showed a couple of my best mates, and they were always the ones who were trying to convince me to do it. Especially when we started going to the parties and stuff, and the raves and the battles.
Because you grew up in West London, didn't you?
Yeah. And we went to our local rap battle was at a place called a night called Mudlums, which was in Dingwalls Camden.
Quite a legendary night now.
Yeah, you know,
and it was part run by the Mud family, and the battles there were ferocious. But it started really at Mudlums. That was the first battle I got in, and like I say, my friends sort of pushed me into it, and I was drunk enough to go with it. And just being up there, the pressure, and eventually getting knocked out as well, it just, I think that solidified it for me. I wanted to convince people that I could do it.
The fact that you've done this battling for years, has that like made you a good stand-up now?
Yeah, no question. I mean, people always balk in interviews at all these so-called, you know, different things that I do, but I don't really see them as being that different, you know. I definitely learn how to act and be funny off the cuff or in a high pressure situation from rap and from battling especially, you know. So that's acting and stand up already sewn up. And then the other thing I do is write. And I was already a writer because I was writing mini movies in song form.
So weird, isn't it? So English.
When people go, oh, how can you possibly do all of these things? I always think, I do all the same things.
Yeah.
Like people interview me acting like I do figure skating as well, and like opera singing.
Do you do figure skating?
I stay in my lane. All the things that I do.
This is a middle class pants moment.
Transferable skills.
No, but I totally agree with you. It's all storytelling, isn't it?
Yeah, ultimately, it's all the same.
You had like an amazing ability. The first time I sort of became aware of you was more that you started a night at The Unreal, didn't you?
Mm.
Which was called Friday Night Live. Yeah. Dude, you did it with Slick Rick, Pete Rock, Feral Munch.
I remember that.
Kanye West, yeah. Mos Def, CeeLo, Black Eyed Peas,
that
Example.
Is insane.
Amy Winehouse, Pro Green.
How'd you get
Wu-Tang?
Slick Rick down. That's mad.
You know, we just basically put out feelers from the start. I mean, in the very, very beginning, we just opened up the mic and it immediately sort of took off, because in those days it was like there wasn't a million rap jams really, and also it was free and it was central, so you could get kids from north, from south, from east, west, and from outside London who'd come down, hang out and freestyle, get on an open mic. And Mos Def was doing a play,
my favorite
at the
rapper.
Phoenix, which doesn't exist anymore, in near Holborn.
Yeah.
And he came down one night and checked it out, and he just loved it. And
organically, he just appeared.
Yeah, yeah. He was living in London for like 3 months doing this play, so called Top Dog Underdog. And he was saying like, we don't like this vibe is kind of dying in the States, you know, this kind of like hip hop for hip hop's sake.
Yeah.
And he was the one that brought Kanye down, and then like from there, amazing, we just started thinking, well, if there's a rapper who's in town, then why don't we just holler at their tour guys and say, look, this is a great way to promote your show to like the hardcore hip hop fans. Come down. You don't have to perform unless you want to.
Yeah.
You just come down and say, hey, what's going on? My show's tomorrow. And leave if you want.
It just sort of blows my mind, though.
Everybody came.
Like Slick Rick. Like, Feral Munch, probably the best lyricist. Well, this is all.
What was Kanye like back then?
Yeah,
he was cool, man. Like, he took us to, he was trying to promote himself. He'd just done,
obviously.
Kanye was trying to promote himself.
Well, this is a different age of Kanye, you have to understand, because people didn't know him as a rapper. Hardcore rap fans knew him, but because he'd produced songs for Jigga.
Yeah.
So he was trying to promote himself as a rapper. He had like one song, I think, or two songs maybe, Jesus Walks and I think Just to Get By.
Oh wow, so it was then.
Yeah. So it was like 2003. Funny. 2002, 2003, and so he was also promoting a young act called the Young Guns, and they were performing at some private party, and they brought us all along. Yeah, he was cool, man, and those guys, they really appreciated Deal Real, and it was Mos who brought Pharo Munch in, and then that led to CeeLo Green, and it just sort of it grew like a tree like that. So each time we did it, we'd have like a big American act who'd either perform or just hang out or just chat, and we'd have like an up and coming.
Because then, I don't know if you want to talk about music anymore, but I just remember seeing your face rock up on things like The Inbetweeners.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Yeah. Like suddenly I'd be like, why is that rapper that I was really into when I was at uni suddenly in all these like sitcoms and stuff? So that was
it was a strange journey, you know, and not one that was planned. Just something that happened. I mean, I got to a stage in 2006, end of 2006, early 2007, where I put out 3 releases and, you know, just trying to hustle them on my own. One label I was signed to, a Brighton-based label, actually folded, and then I recouped the rights to the album that I put out with them, and I had to, you know, self-release that again, like re-release it, but myself. And I had these 2 other releases to sell as well, and I just found the business of it really difficult because there was not really an industry for UK rap at the time, and it just got to the point where I was just like, you know, I just had a kid, this is just long, like I need to get a proper job.
Your father at
so
that
I
point,
thought yeah insane. So I thought you know what I'll do is just do one more album, make it the best thing I'd ever done. Because at the same time, I'd been touring with Mark Ronson, so I'd seen a side of music.
Which is
music.
Crazy. I mean, just drop that. I mean, you were doing that first big band album. It was like Amy Winehouse.
We were working the songs that ended up on Version.
And
that's
you
what we were doing.
And you were sort of dropping, because I remember seeing that live, and you came out and
I would
dropping
rap
all the Ghostface Killah tracks.
Yeah, on Ooey, and I'd rap on Lost Souls Forever.
Unbelievable.
And sometimes Valerie. Sometimes, oh my God!
I mean, I got
you know,
to ask
and I was there when these songs were first performed.
I mean, what was it like working with Amy Winehouse? I mean, I got to ask that.
She
was
like,
fan.
she was like, I mean, you grew up in a similar area to me, and if you met Amy, you would recognise her immediately as one of those classic kind of Stanwell rowdy girls. North London girls.
Smoking weed all the time. I remember meeting her once on Primrose Hill. She was just blazing.
We used to just blaze a zoot and catch joke. That was literally it. She was the type of person. You know when you meet the type of people who, when you meet them, they start taking the piss out of you, and then if you take it serious, then you know you're not going to be friends.
Exactly.
It's a good way of testing out whether you're going to be mates with someone. Like, take the piss out of them and see if they can deal with it.
Yeah.
She was very much like that. She just rinse you straight away. But yeah, she was just pure jokes, man. And she was such a sort of free spirit. And it was only towards the end of my time working with her and with Mark that things started to take a turn for the worse. And then after that, I was off the scene. So I couldn't tell you anything about the other stuff, but it's well documented.
It must have been really surreal watching that Asif Kapaldi film.
Yeah, I mean, Asif, I'm credited as a researcher and a contributor on that film. And Asif contacted me.
What a film, by the way, if you haven't watched that movie.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's a bit like watching a horror film.
It is, isn't it? It's like a slow car crash.
Yeah.
And if you haven't seen Senna as well, we're hoping Senna's amazing, going to come on the podcast at some point.
Asif's such a cool guy.
Isn't
he called me, and when I found out what it was about, I was just like, nah.
Yeah,
because
this just could have been awful.
At that stage, I didn't know that he was the guy that done Senna. If I'd have known that, I probably would have thought about it for longer. But whenever people asked me about her pre that movie, I always just went, nah, I've got no comment or nothing to say, because it was still so raw, and there's so much bullshit said about her by people who never met her, and so much controversy and debate about who's responsible for what. I just didn't want to get involved, especially not with a product as big as a movie.
Sure. My feeling after watching that film was that the only sane response to being in the fulcrum of that kind of madness that it is to be that famous is to go mad.
That's why I never understand why people judge like the Michael Jacksons, the Whitney Houstons of this world by their standards.
You should be
How
more
can
concerned,
you judge them by your standards?
But you should be more concerned about the people that don't go mad. Like, I'm sorry, but Jay-Z and Beyonce, they must be sociopaths not to go completely mad at the amount of fame and attention.
Well, I think it's different with Jigga, because, you know, someone like that built a business around it. He built, like, what you're talking about with Winehouse particularly is like, it's like a supernova appearing out of nowhere. It's like one day suddenly a billion flashbulbs are going off outside your door when there was not one yesterday. And I think
Beyonce was trained for fame.
Yeah, her
from
dad.
Birth.
I mean,
and Jigga had hundreds of thousands of dollars in the street before he became a rapper. Mm. And I'm just going to guess that the pressure of people knowing you had drug money in the street in Brooklyn comparable. In the late 80s must have been way more pressure than being like a famous rapper.
Because that was
what I mean. He doesn't have to watch his back now. Like,
exactly.
Yeah. Like, back then, he must have constantly been thinking,
I'm going to get killed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And totally. You know there was paranoia with Jigga because, I mean, he shot his own brother.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? Like, what must he have been going through at that time?
So, look, I want to go on and talk about I Am Bear, which is, if you haven't checked it out, it's, and if you've got kids, it's amazing. I mean, when did
Thank you
start to be, I mean, do you know how I found out about it? My godson.
Yeah. Really?
It's like, gave it to me. And then I was like, yesterday when we started properly talking on the phone, and I looked at it, I was like, oh my God, that's his as well?
That's a beautiful thing. I'm so glad that you found out about it that way. I had my first daughter when in 2005. Mm. And so since then, I've obviously been reading children's books. I mean, she just reads herself now, but like in the early days, obviously you're reading like picture books and stuff like that. And I was surprised by the lack of quality control in children's publishing.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many classics and there's great new ones all the time. But I guess just like everything else, movies, music, they're the minority.
Yeah.
There's so much stuff that's just chucked out there and just smothered in glitter and shit. And
top three or four best children's books that you'd recommend? Because I'm all about Where the Wild Things Are.
Word of Wild Things is no doubt a classic. I would say Not Now, Bernard.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Not Now, Bernard.
Are you joking?
Sounds a bit...
What, have you never read that?
Not Now, Bernard is amazing.
You must have been read that when you were a kid.
No, Not Now, Bernard.
Not Now, Bernard is a brilliant narrative.
It's a book about parental neglect.
Exactly. Oh, right.
It's incredible.
It's so dark. Yeah.
So dark.
It's so off-key.
So the best ones are ones that appeal to adults as well. Like
Yeah, just like a good cartoon. You know, you want to be able to watch it with your kids. And the best children's books were always like that. I liked the Mog series as well by Judith Kerr. I thought a couple of those were kind of groundbreaking. I like Richard Scarry's stuff. Obviously, Roald Dahl.
He's the Don.
Yeah, he's the king.
He's the absolute G.
His adult stuff is incredible as well.
Listen, but I'm getting a bit peckish.
Let's move on to some
food.
We've
got loads of stuff. So let's just start with this. Do you like starters? Are you sort of three course sort of?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, what's your favourite starter?
In general, I think I like whitebait. I think whitebait's a good one, man.
I'm so with you, man. Grease, whitebait, bang.
Yeah, whitebait.
Grease, whitebait, bang.
But in Greece, you eat a lot of whitebait.
Grease, whitebait, bang.
Whitebait, bang. Sounds like a fucking Harry Enfield sketch.
If I was going...
Grease, whitebait, bang.
If I was going Turkish, I like a little halloumi salad.
Nice. Do you like to fry your halloumi? Do you like halloumi?
Yeah, very much so. It's the wrongest thing in the world, isn't it? Frying cheese.
It's the best, though, isn't it?
It's so good, man.
So, what have you brought for our metaphorical starter, Dog Brown?
Well, for our metaphorical starter, I was just thinking, like recently I had an argument with somebody because we were talking about Facebook, right? And I was like, I was putting up my case against it. And I was saying, that's why I haven't got a Facebook page. And they were like, but you have got a Facebook page. I've seen it. Right. And I was like, yeah, but that's not me. It's just
that's
like a
work.
It's like a Doc Brown fan page thing where you can just get news about me, you know. And the fact that they even thought it was my personal Facebook page kind of backed up my point. My point being that I'm slightly perturbed, and I think this is because of my age. Like, I was just on the cusp, like you guys, of you know, that digital revolution sort of kind of taking it or leaving it.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people were just like, nah, that sounds rubbish.
That's not going to catch on.
I remember in 1993 watching Newsround, and John Craven was saying... John Craven was saying
he was talking about
the information superhighway.
Yeah.
At the end of the piece he said, so one day you could order a pizza or buy a jumper on the interweb. And I was just like, Craven, you've lost your mind, mate.
You're losing it, Craven. You're mad.
Somebody put this geezer out to pasture because he's gone bonkers.
He's called the Domino's Act before it's even fucking happened.
Right, exactly. So when it did finally come around, I was a bit like, I'd do my emails and whatnot, but I don't know if I'm into all these other bits and pieces.
These wild,
obviously,
wild kids.
Obviously, now I've got Twitter and Instagram, but that's it. I don't feel like I need anything else. And the Facebook thing, I know every single person in the world is on it, and I know I'm a bit of an anomaly, like, not being on it. But the thing that always concerned me about Facebook was the way that it reduced a person. I don't think it boosts people, I think it reduces them to this format. We agree to this format, like, this is how I'm going to describe myself in a way that has been designed by some guy called Mark, and it's like blue and white, and here are my lists of likes and here's my best photo, and that is how you're willing to describe yourself to people.
Sure.
And so my starter, really, in short, is being that I'm, I guess, something of a celebrity or whatever, I wonder if, like, we've created a world of celebrities. Like, is every single person on the planet essentially a celebrity sort of in their own mind?
Yeah.
Right? That's my starter, because if you create a Facebook page, Instagram page, Twitter, and I'm not separating myself from this at all, but if you do that, what are you showing people about yourself? If you set up a Facebook page, is your profile picture gonna be you know, taking a shit or like beating your kid? Do you know what I mean? I'm sure there probably are a couple of those, because there's some twisted people.
I reckon there's probably a couple
world.
Of things like, mate, you can't be beating your kid.
Ultimately, so you're saying, showing only the best of you.
I've got
so every Facebook page is like a first date.
If the world ended tomorrow and, you know, humanity disappeared and there was a new group of people that sort of started a culture in the future and they looked back and all they could find was Instagram, they'd be like, oh my God, those guys back then, they were having the best time.
Hashtag loving life. Hashtag YOLO. Yeah.
It's true. What do you think, though, Hayden?
Because you've got quite serious views about Facebook, don't you? You think it's like...
Well, me and you have like completely different Facebook, Instagram styles. Jolyon posts everything all the fucking time.
It's because I'm insecure. It's true. And it's also, he cussed me even when I set up a fan page. Because I was like, look, I think it's important. And he was like, what are you doing? And I was like, well, I think it's important that we can aggregate a community. And then he's like, no, doesn't matter. But I treat
it really practically. To be fair, you're really good like at promoting stuff. I just don't do it. And I get really like self-conscious about it. But I feel like... I feel like you become a spammer. Actually,
but I think you even get more insecure about it because then he has to post like ironically bad photos.
Yeah, because I'm trying to. Oh my God, I so don't care. Because you post everything all the time. I'm like, I'm like so conscious of our friends that have to like read every single.
All my friends have unfollowed me,
so I don't post any of them.
That's what I would do. I mean, I set up just recently a private Instagram page so I can share shit of my actual friends and family because I don't post. Pictures of my kids on Instagram.
No, I think that's
because
good.
I think, like, it's just out there all of a sudden.
I agree.
What about their rights?
Yeah,
to it's privacy.
Not, it's not cool.
I don't know what people are doing with pictures of my daughters. Yeah, do you know what I mean? I don't want to know. So I set up a private one so I could at least share. Because I love going on my friends' Instagrams and seeing their kids and what they're doing with their lives on a non-celebrity tip.
But
I can't do it myself.
To be devil's advocate, like, what is the difference? You're saying, oh, it's just sort of like, you know, curating the best bits of your life and it's not true, it's not honest. But what is the difference between that and like when you used to go around someone's house and they're like, oh, let me get the photo album out because we went on this amazing holiday. You don't get pics in that of them like shouting at their kid because they...
Well, but you kind of did because...
I think if you look at the photos in my family from the 80s, some of them were terrible.
Like, it's true.
You know, there's one brilliant one. Like I hated sand when I was a toddler. And there's one brilliant one. My sister made an amazing little like... Happy birthday, Ben, out of like shells and stones in the sand. It was really sweet. Yeah. And the photo of me enjoying that at like 2 years old or 3 years old, I'm just trying to rip away from my mum's hands. And I'm just like screaming and crying. I look like I'm being like abused. And it just says happy birthday, Ben, underneath. And that's a photo. And then at the end of the set, you just have like a photo of like the door or like the curb. Or your feet, because you're just trying to finish off the pack. Do you know what I'm saying? And on top of it, the other difference is, if you did invite me around your house to go through the photo album, that would be a social, an actual social event where we link eyes and we talk about shit. We actually share stuff and we can share private stuff while we're talking about it.
Because I guess what you're saying is, it's not only is it reductive, photos generally are reductive, there's just a captured image of something that's, you know, not... 1D, 2D, but what is happening is that people consider their Instagram like a social act in itself. It's like posting something is the same as showing something to your friend. Like
I get
in person.
I do get it, and I respect it. I just think it's a little bit of a retrograde step when you consider what we've done, humanity-wise, like what we've created.
Because I feel like the same can be said about. You know, Twitter, Facebook. I mean, Twitter's different because Twitter's reductive. You know, people use Twitter to kind of argue about stuff and, like, you know, voice their opinions. But it's just as reductive. It's like,
no question.
It's a different thing.
But it's
I think it's a totally different thing, Hayden. Because if you have a picture of yourself, right? And I'm going to talk about some research that I was just doing before on this.
Yeah, okay.
Because what I think Doc's going on about is the idea that our physical persona, our image of ourselves. The best image of ourselves that we're trying to put out to people has this new type of pressure on it, like a celebrity that has a kind of like...
Exactly.
We were just talking about Amy before.
This is exactly what I wanted to say in a long-winded way. That's the point.
No problem, bro. I just like showing it.
What is the real reason that we want to display ourselves in this way?
Well, I think it's like what you were saying before about celebrity. So I was doing some research, and according to Forbes, the Center for Media, Technology and Health, in a statement... polled 1,787 adults in the US between 19 and 32. And the questionnaires given to their participants requested details about social media usage. From there, the answers were coordinated with a depression assessment tool. And the social media platforms
in the questionnaire included Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Google+, Instagram, Snapchat, Reddit, Tumblr, Pinterest, Vine, LinkedIn. And according to the questionnaire results, the participants used social media for more than 61 minutes per day and visited various social media accounts 30 times per week on average were far more depressed. What made the study alarming was that there were a quarter of the participants were classified as having high indicators of depression. There were significant and linear associations between social media usage and depression, whether social media was measured based on total time spent or frequencies to the visits. Now, I think we've all seen this, haven't we? Like friends who suddenly seem like absolutely screwing because they're like my mate, I've got a friend who, I think it's probably best to remain nameless actually for this, but he is angry at people's Facebook. Like he'll call me up and go, have you seen what they've posted? Yeah. And I'm like, why is this a subject? I just can't believe that they'd say that. And I'm like, it surprises me that it has had such, and I'm not,
but that's what you're saying, the same thing. This is the thing about social media, is how fucking antisocial it is. Yeah. That's the weird thing about it. And I think it's the same with Twitter. It's like, you've ever had one of those relationships where it didn't really work out very well and most of the problems were caused by text messaging, right? Someone sends a text and you've like, oh my God, I can't believe that. And you've like completely misread it and then you have this huge falling out. That is social media completely encapsulated right there.
Yeah.
Like, no, there's no nuance in it whatsoever. And it's the same with Instagram posting your pictures. It's the same with opinions. If the UN spoke to each other purely in 140 characters, there'd be a nuclear war within a week.
Yeah, no question. Yeah.
Thank
God. My eight-year-old said to me, how does someone know if you're being sarcastic in a text?
That's brilliant.
And I thought, what a question that is.
Yeah. Eight years old. We were speaking to John Lloyd in the last podcast, and he was talking about how children are there actually to teach us.
They are, and they're already rejecting some of the things that we're so irresponsible as the people who have designed all of this stuff.
Yeah.
Down to WhatsApp and Snapchat and all this stuff. We've designed it with absolutely no consideration whatsoever for how it affects small children.
Totally.
And also we've designed it with no barriers to small children so they can just use it.
Well, that's like the thing that scares
A 5-year old can just access hardcore porn looking for pussies. Do you know what I mean?
God. But like genuinely, it's really funny, one
click of a button. Yeah. And we don't give a shit. Yeah. We just don't care. And
but wasn't that the same in...
Thank God for small children, because they reject a lot of these things because they're not entertaining.
Yeah.
So like my eldest daughter, she started a WhatsApp group with some of her friends and she accessed it via my phone. So I could keep an eye on the conversations, and 99% innocent. Yeah. And then something turned at some point and it became like a bullying thing. And she was just like, I don't want to be a part of this.
Yeah.
And it's similar. There's a thing that they all love called Musical.ly. Have you seen that? Where you can make little music videos.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
It's really good fun. It's good, honest fun. And she's also rejected that in part because she doesn't want to share stuff. She wants to be able to make her little music video, but she doesn't want to throw it out there. Yeah. And that's because she knows that already, tragically, you put your head above the precipice and you get abused.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's so, there's nothing easier for a coward than abusing someone from behind a keyboard.
Bullying took place before the internet.
Yeah, but keyboard warriors are able to chase it.
Of course it did. I guarantee you the amount of people that have said derogatory things on Twitter, out of all of them, 99% of them wouldn't have said shit to my face in school.
Totally.
Right, so you think there's a bit of protection. That's the difference. There and they're just
cowards. I don't think it's, I mean, you know, my godson's 12 now, I was having a conversation with him a while ago and he was explaining to me that, you know, his dad used to be able to just go home, chill out with his mum and dad. If someone called the house to say something rude, it would be very unusual and how he's discussed it. But for them, it's 24/7, it doesn't stop. And I want to read you something else that I was reading, because this is really, really shocking. Yeah. And I think it shows that there's a genuine like epidemic and our country has a huge problem. And one of the things that a lot of this research is saying is that the government don't want to act because social media companies are so powerful and pervasive. And now, obviously, after Brexit, we're also begging them to come. I don't know if you know this. Apple have taken half of Battersea Power Station. Facebook apparently opening up a new office. But this research, which was published in The Guardian by Maeve Kennedy, suggests that more than a third of teenage girls in England suffer from depression and anxiety. Number of those reporting symptoms increased from 33 to 37% in 2005. And this is really, really dangerous because depression and anxiety, the article goes on to say, have risen among teenage girls in England, with more than a third reporting symptoms of distress, although the rates are stable among teenage boys. Among 37% reported feeling unhappy, worthless, or unable to concentrate. More than twice the percentage of boys reported feeling such feelings. Now, another writer who I'd really recommend reading her stuff, she's called June Eric Andori, and she's a mental health writer in The Guardian. And she talks about mental social media harming mental health of teenagers. And she basically talks a lot about her teenage sister, who's only 14 years old, and how a lot of the time her parents have worked out that they turn the Wi-Fi off at 11 p.m. But then her sister will absolutely harangue her, saying, look, can you turn your phone into a hotspot? I'm really desperate to like get online again, because they've got such FOMO, because there's such pressure for them to actually continually interact. Like, it's sort of a totally different thing. Like, I wouldn't think anything if I texted you, Hayden, and you just didn't text me back, but apparently now there's like, if you that don't respond happens. Within 10 minutes
you where call
are
me
you? What are you doing? No, what are you doing? What are you saying? What are you doing? Well, basically I'm
You'll
a 14
text me and then
I'm
clearly call me 5 minutes later.
Well, clearly I've got a lot in common with a 14 year old teenage girl, okay? It's not my fault. But listen, basically it says, and this is the whole thing, that they're staying up all night trying to do this. And this is even worse for teenagers, because a new study found that teenagers who engage in social media during the night could be damaging their sleep and increasing their risk of anxiety and depression, because teenagers need more sleep than anyone.
Of course they do.
It's super shocking. I mean, what can we do about this? I mean, it's
well, I mean, it starts at home, doesn't it? And you have to be engaged with your children. I'm 2 years away from having a teenage girl.
Wow.
So, you know,
good luck,
it's something that keeps me awake at night. I don't need social media to keep me awake at night. I just lie there terrified every night about the future, you know. But I think it starts at home. I've raised both my daughters to have a sense of adventure, have a desire to experience the world firsthand and limit their screen time. You know, I know parents who don't give their kids any screen time at all. And I think I don't think that's an answer. Mm. You know, I think you need to introduce them to this world, but also to the dangers and the pitfalls of it at the same time. Mm. And I'm trying to do that as best I can. And, you know, at some stage I will not have that level of control, because a teenager is going to do what a teenager is going to do. But I think I've already laid the foundations to create two heroes, like two people who are going to add something good to the world. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And that foundation is laid, psychologists will tell you, within the first couple of years.
Totally.
Do you know what I mean? So like, a lot of my job is done already. Neither of my daughters are ever going to kill anybody. They're not, my thing I'm proudest of, they're not going to be pricks.
Yeah.
Thing is, a kid teaches a man how to love. And I'm saying a man because women are good with that emotion. They know how to nurture. You know, a man often has to learn how. And one of the easiest ways is to have this little creature that you're 100% responsible for. The love is intense. I don't think I really knew what love was before I built a relationship with these girls, wow. You know? And it's all encompassing in a good way. If you're already quite a sort of go-getting type of guy, or someone with drive like I was, like, your kid's not going to stunt your growth. It's not going to freak you out to the point where you're completely immobilized. It's going to drive you on to do even better. Yeah. Put it this way, right? When my first daughter was born, I was broke. I was out of the rap game. I had nothing. My missus was carrying me. And yet I decided to get on a stage and try and tell jokes and see what happens. Like, it's unbelievable what I've achieved since I've become a parent.
Do you think you did it partly because you were sort of spurred on to do so by having a kid?
I didn't want to be one of them dads who gets to fucking 35 or 40 and then starts like being a dick because they resent the existence of their kids. Yeah. They look at their kids as like, oh, because of you I had to go and work for this insurance company doing data entry, you know what I mean? Because I had to, because of you. And then when their kids goes like, oh, I want to be a dancer, or I want to see the world, I want to go on a gap year, you're like, fuck you, you know what I did for you. And then you're a bit dick to your wife, and then you go and like fuck some 21 year old girl, and you buy some stupid car, and you're having a midlife crisis. I should be having that midlife crisis now in my late 30s, and I've never been happier. I've never been more satisfied. And I look in my daughter's eyes and I just think it's unbelievable what I've managed to do over the past decade.
That's amazing, man.
What I've done in the past decade puts the rest of my life into, like, it just pales into insignificance almost.
Jesus, man, that's so powerful.
When we said all the stuff at the beginning about writer, comics, stand-up, rapper, we should have been parent, mate.
Yeah, all of those things was born out of parenting.
That's fascinating,
before,
man.
Before my children was born, I was a two-bit rapper. That's what I was. You know?
Two-bit's a bit harsh. I think it's pretty good. I think we saw you before you've made that. So listen, we got to. I'm getting pretty hungry. I like a good bit of a main course. What's your sort of vibe on a Sunday? You're not a vegetarian, are you? Vegetarian?
I'm not a vegetarian.
Are you a chicken guy?
No, I like most meat. I don't really eat a lot of. I don't eat any shellfish, but I do like fish.
So would you cook like a salmon? Would you be like a salmon?
I'm not really into salmon. No, I like. I'm real basic when it comes to fish. I like trout or like cod. You know,
nice.
But
on
you know,
a Sunday, would you do that
on a Sunday? On a Sunday, I would go one of two ways. Obviously, I love an English roast.
Yeah, man.
You know, you can't go far wrong with a good
can't
roast.
Can't go far wrong with an old English roast.
Nah, but and then also I do like, you know, my mum's Jamaican, and occasionally we'll have Aki. Like we'll go Jamaican for a Sunday
bang.
Lunch. And ackee and saltfish is
good.
I mean, it's technically a breakfast in Jamaica.
That blows my mind, mate.
Mate, a Jamaican breakfast like in Jamaica is insane.
Totally. I was in Ocho Rios and someone gave me ackee and saltfish for breakfast. I thought they were taking the piss.
Yeah, you got
I thought they were like white boy.
For those, that don't know, like ackee and saltfish is essentially like a kind of fish curry.
It's delicious. You know,
with ackee, the Jamaican national fruit, which kind of is the consistency of scrambled egg. Mixed with saltfish and chili.
Yeah.
And you'll have that with rice for breakfast. And I'm not saying you're having that on its own. You'll have that with...
Plantain.
You'll have it with, like, yam, hard food, potatoes. Like, so much carbs.
So true.
And if that's not enough carbs, they'll throw in a couple of festivals as well, which is like a sweet, sugary fried dumpling. And that is for breakfast. And yet you never see fat Jamaicans.
Tell us what you brought for a main, for your main course, your meaty main.
My meaty main is kind of leading on from the nature of social media and abusing it or misusing it. I'm thinking about the king of the misuser of Twitter, the virtually illiterate leader of the free world, Donald Trump.
The orange.
And you know, he's got what, 21 million followers?
Yeah.
So my main course is really why are we as Brits so obsessed with American politics? That's my main course. Because, you know, listen, I get it. It's big news. The Super Bowl's big news. But there's some shit that has flown under the radar right in our backyard, politically speaking, in these,
because of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Hogging the
and
headlines.
Yet, like, if I turn on Twitter, if I turn on the news, people talk like
obsessively.
But not even obsessively, Jay. It's almost like I don't think we should stand.
I know, it's totally
why
insane.
Is Donald Trump our leader? And bruv, you're from Stoke-on-Trent. He's not your leader.
Like, the leader of the free world, like, and Stoke-on-Trent.
By all means, he's an absolute bell end and we should be concerned.
Yeah.
I don't
but
know.
If we're going to start getting concerned about world leaders, what about that Filipino guy who's just murdering motherfuckers?
Murking, bruv.
Donald Trump's not out there like killing people.
Yeah. Well, not yet.
Well, listen, look, we've got different opinions on that.
I'm devil's advocate. I'm not saying it's not big news.
No, but it is mental.
Saying,
so
why,
like,
do we pick and choose?
So to take the counter position on that, I would say that isn't it true? Okay, first of all, you know, it's the most powerful country on earth, by far in terms of its military, in terms of its number of nuclear weapons. Our entire geopolitical position is defined by their entire geopolitical position. And not only that, but the only reason the UK has maintained its position in the world is because we happen to speak the same fucking language as Americans. Mm-hmm. That is genuinely it. It's basically the biggest market in the world just across the pond from us. And that's the only reason we're still vaguely important in Europe. So it is kind of important for Brits. I don't know about the Europeans. And in fact, if you go to Europe, and all this stuff was happening in Trump, if you go around Spain, you go around Italy, people don't care half as much. It's just the UK.
I think the question is why are we so obsessed?
You're 100% right. But that said, like, I feel, and I've always felt, I mean, you can take this as UKIP-y as you want it, but I'm proud to be British. I love being British. I've always felt that way, you know? Despite being an ethnic minority even, I love being British, and I find it as depressing as the flipping BNP and the EDL. I find it as depressing as them that we have a huge lack of industry, a huge lack of export, that we're not Great Britain. And I don't mean that in an empirical way. I mean that in a philosophical way. I'd like to feel proud of my country in the same way that when you go to various countries around Europe, around the globe, you see their flags everywhere. That every other country is nationalist apart from us.
Well, we are.
If you say you're a nationalist here, you're a racist.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I want to be able to be proud of the Union Jack.
Yeah.
And I feel like we're just this like dicky little brother of America.
Right,
I feel like we're the guy. You remember in the playground when there was a bully who would be like punch you for no reason?
Like Richard Hammond.
The worst guy was not the bully.
It was the guy standing next to him.
It was the Richard Hammond bread behind him going, yeah. We're like that guy with America.
So you're saying it's an abusive relationship.
Yeah, it was always an abusive relationship.
I don't know if you've been watching Taboo, you know, Tom Hardy's thing on BBC One, which is like about the East India Company and basically the time where the 15 states kind of like decided to flip it. And I think we are in basically this weird kind of like, you know, role reversal. And I think we should sort of take this right back, because I think before we get onto the American politics thing, first of all, you've got to ask before that, like, why are we so obsessed with America? So you and me were talking about this on the phone. Like, we grew up with American advertising. Transformers, He-Man, Ninja Turtles, all the cartoons I watched when I was a kid, American accents. Being American was definitively cool. It was cool. And I wanted to know everything about that country. And it was only when I started doing history A-level and I started understanding that JFK, for instance, wasn't just a totally amazing symbol of freedom, but actually he was a total philanderer who would like fly women into the White House and having affairs while his wife was like out. And I was like, oh, that's not so good. And then you start learning about America's role in the world and the realities of all the military interventions that have taken place since the Second World War, where essentially they have kind of messed with any number of South American countries, created sort of third parties,
Democracy. So you got disillusioned by America.
But my point is that a lot of people don't get that level of education. A lot of people, we're really lucky to have that education, and people are obsessed with being American. Being American and being cool are still, irrespective of Donald Trump,
that is a widely held opinion now to hate America, quote unquote, imperialism.
You still want to go to New York. You still want to go to LA. You still want to go to Miami.
I think it's the easiest thing for Brits to go, oh yeah, America is mad, like they're all nutters, they all got guns, blah blah blah. If I say to people, like, I went to LA for the first time at the end of last year,
which we're going
to
talk about in a minute,
to go and present the BAFTAs, you know,
unbelievable.
I've never had a desire to work in Hollywood, but the job was offered, I went and did it.
Yeah.
When I told people I was going, like, if you could see these British people's eyes light up, it was like the first time they respected something that I'd done.
Yeah.
Because I was working in real show business.
Yes,
you know
what I mean? Exactly.
Like, it's bullshit. Like, I went out there and, it's LA. Like, it's just another city.
Totally.
You know? It can't fuck with London in the slightest. I'll put myself on record saying that. But, you know, I'm a Londoner, so what are you going to do? But yeah, you know, the way people's eyes lit up, it just took me back to school where there was only one kid in my school, Benjamin Wensley, who'd been to America.
Yeah.
And he'd been to America over summer holiday. I still to this day don't even know if he was lying, because like we would test him every day. Like, what did you see? What did you see? And one day he snapped and said, I saw the Batmobile. I don't know if he went or not. I think he did. But I don't know if the Batmobile was true. But, you know, like, it was legendary that he'd been.
Yeah.
You know, and it was kind of like that, just talking to actual like educated grown-ups.
It blew my mind.
Like, I'm in LA. You're in LA.
Yeah.
It's like, even when I go to New York, I go to New York to see my sister or my brother-in-law. They both live there and have done for 10 years. So like,
so can I just
go out and see them? And if I say, oh, I'm going to New York, oh my God, what are you going to do? Like, what are you going to do? Like, what are you filming? What are you doing? Oh my God.
Can we take it as read? You don't drop your pin at JFK Airport when you arrive there.
Hashtag living life. Hashtag love
hashtag
London.
Living the dream.
But no, going back to the politics thing, because this is really important, is there is a huge amount of stuff going on right now. We live in a time after the Brexit vote where on the left, you're a liberal elitist. On the right, you're a racist.
Yep.
And we have an unelected prime minister.
Yeah.
We have a prime minister who is overseeing a fundamental transition of power between us and the European Union. A prime minister who oversaw at the Home Office the complete annihilation of privacy rights. Mm-hmm. The same person who kept her head so far below the precipice, the pulpit during the actual Brexit vote that she was literally the last one standing in the saloon.
Yeah.
You had no idea what she thinks. Nope. Supposedly a Remainer who is then prepared to come out and argue with ferocious bile that anyone who questions the will of the British people is to be absolutely annihilated. And you only have to look at, you know, the way that Gina Miller, who brought the case, which he's quite entitled to do in the court, saying that Parliament is sovereign and that the Prime Minister can't simply just have a veto over whether or not we decide to leave the EU. And the bile that was spit at our independent judiciary. I was reading today that they've suddenly decided that if the House of Lords stands up against the Brexit vote, that they'll just abolish it. And we are living in very strange times. And I think the point you're making, Doc, I think is you're saying, let me ask you, like, what are the things we should be looking at in British politics?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, you've just hit the nail on the head. I couldn't say it any more succinctly than that. Like, there are so many wide-reaching concerns. Like, we have Thatcher reincarnate at the helm, and we didn't even vote for her. Like you said, that is a concern. That is something that everybody should be talking about. The complete non-interest in the housing crisis is a huge concern. The complete non-interest in protecting our freedom of access to healthcare is a huge concern, and it's all just being eked away into nothing, into more support for the same fucking fat cats, which is what you expect from the Tory party, I guess. But it's worse than ever, and the division between rich and poor, these are the things that should concern every British person, and instead we've just got this fucking clown in the White House. Just, you know, it's Reagan and Thatcher all over again. We got an actor in the White House. Mm-hmm. It ties into that whole Hollywood fascination, celebrity fascination, a reality TV star making the decisions. And as you rightly said, you know, the most powerful man in the world. So of course we're interested. I'm just saying, like, not at the expense of your own lives and what immediately affects you and your families and your actual interests and your actual money, you know.
But isn't the decision now, because of what Joel said about Brexit, the decision now is kind of Europe or America, you know,
very much so. And like, for me,
with our European,
for me it's Europe all day, but that's just my opinion, you know. I think what we look like to the world is so embarrassing right now. Like, I'm not saying we were ever popular. Like, I think Londoners have always been quite popular. I mean, I'm lucky enough to have traveled the world, you know, and everywhere I go people will say, oh, you're from London, because they see it as iconic, you know.
Yeah.
Like Mary Poppins,
it reminds me of Paul Rudd in that film, always like, you're from London, man.
but you know, on the whole, we're not well liked because of what we did to most countries around the world. And the old empire. And I totally get that. But now, like, it's just embarrassing. Like, Europe looking at us, like, everyone looking at us like, who the fuck do you lot think you are? This tiny little island. Like, what are you hoping to gain? And that concerns me.
I think what you're saying, something that Hayden and I feel very regularly, is we're very lucky when we make the show. We just finished the show Revolting, and we have a huge research period, and we're very lucky to be able to have the time to look into some of this stuff, which I know for a fact a lot of my friends who are very intelligent people, they just can't look at it. Cause it's just too depressing for them.
It's too scary.
And What is terrifying me is exactly what you're talking about, is that the ground is being taken away from my feet. I thought when I was growing up that the NHS would be there forever. I thought that we would always live in a country where we basically take care of the elderly. These basic facets of what I thought my social contract was as a citizen of the Crown in the UK, a subject of the Crown, are being sort of, they're being eroded at a speed that is unprecedented. And like, do you know what shocks me at the minute, Haid? Do you remember when it was all just the deficit and mm-hmm. austerity? Yeah. And that language was like, oh, we have to get rid of all social housing because austerity. We have to get rid of the NHS because that fucking word doesn't even exist anymore in the lexicon. What do you think, bro?
I think it needs to happen in order for people to wake up. I mean, think about, you know, this is the Frankie Boyle article in The Guardian that I just read about. Where is the Bob Dylan of 2017? You've got more material than ever before. And people, you know, you've got Kanye West and Kim Kardashian that are just sort of, you know, apolitical kind of social media imbeciles. And I think it's changing, though. I think people are
Bill
waking
Cosby
up.
Bill Cosby innocent.
Do you know what's mad? Kim is tweeting.
So this is what I'm saying. So now Kim is starting to get political. And I think it's on the cusp of the worst and the best. It's the best of times and the worst of times, right?
Yeah.
So
it's always darkest before the dawn.
It's going to change. And I think it needs to get really bad in the immediate future with Brexit in order for people to wake up.
History tells us that, you know. History tells us that, you know, even Rome burnt, you know.
Yeah.
History tells us that you destroy and rebuild, unfortunately. So I think you're right. I think it might get darker. But I have to say I'm not one of these gloom mongerers who's I know a lot of nihilists right now. That gets to me because I'm just
me
like,
too.
Bro, you know what you are? You're not a nihilist. You're fucking lazy.
Yeah. Exactly.
You are taking the absolute easy route out. You don't want to speak up about anything because there's no point. Mm. You don't want to do anything because there's no point. That is not a nihilist. You're not taking a political stance. You're just a lazy prick.
So on that point.
Can I the two things I really think is really important. So firstly, I totally agree with you. There's lots of people at the minute who I think you need to ask yourself a fundamental question. If you are university educated in this country, if you have had the luxury of an education and you're not participating in the social process, then for me, you're part of the problem. The time for the kind of inertia of the 90s and the early 2000s, it's gone.
Yeah.
You act now. And I am so pleased to see that there are even podcast titles now where protest is the new brunch. You know, I literally read a Guardian article today that said, check out the 12 best protests to go to this spring.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, I'm happy.
Number 7 will shock you.
Yeah, I'm going to...
that's always
I'm not joking. I'm going to read them out because I think it's that important. Because we're at a stage now where, unless we start acting, and I think you're right, you know, we talked about America before in that, how it creates
We need to
that.
Go beyond protests.
We need to go beyond protests. Creative direct
What we need to
actions.
Do is what I've been doing the last few days is booking up Trump hotel rooms and then cancelling them within a day of my visit, because you're allowed to do that without getting charged. And I call up the Trump hotel and I say, do you know what, I'm really sorry,
this
but
is hilarious.
My Iranian boyfriend feels a bit awkward about coming to America.
That's amazing.
So we're going to get millions of people to do it. You have to tweet this. We get millions of people to do it. You book on booking.com, right? And then you can cancel within a day of your visit.
Totally
Everyone
legal.
Does it. You have to tweet it and Instagram it and say that you've done it and get all your followers to do the same thing.
The 6 mass UK demonstrations to join this spring. On the 15th of April, you can join the Tax March, which is a march to talk about the absolute unfairness of a man who's a billionaire president not actually paying his own taxes. On the 22nd of April, there's the March for Science, because we have a lunatic in the White House who doesn't believe in climate change. On the 29th of April, it's the People's Climate March. We're actually going to say, hello, Exxon. We're not too happy about the fact that you're suddenly drilling for oil again. On the 6th of May, though, and I personally think this is the most important of all of them, it's the Immigrants March, to talk about the fact that we live in a country that is absolutely built on the back of immigrants in a very literal and philosophical way. And then on the 11th of June, it's the National Pride March, an absolutely vital time at a time where LGBT rights are again under threat. And on the 16th of September, there's the Jugglers March, which is basically lots of clowns, which I don't totally understand. That's part of the list as well.
think you should go to as many of those marches as possible, and anyone listening should get down there. And as you said, if you're not, you're part of the problem.
And there's an NHS march that's coming up, and we're very lucky. We get to speak to an awful lot of doctors and nurses, and the pressure that they were
like,
under.
Like today?
Yeah, like today.
Like Doc Brown.
Like Doc Brown. Yeah. You work in the NHS, don't you?
On a real tip, though, my sister-in-law does. She's an amazing doctor and anaesthetist, and I'd like to shout her out because the amount of times she's been offered just private contracts and going and just making 20 times as much money as she does.
Yeah.
And she just refuses to leave. And she just works saving lives.
Amazing.
Anybody's lives that needs saving every day. And I don't know how the hell she does it.
But I'm so sick of hearing Radio 4 on the Today programme, hearing supposed experts coming and telling us that the problem is benefit tourism, is people coming over here to have
benefit
their babies.
Tourism.
The problem is chronic underfunding of public services. And like Theresa May, like, they think we're thick.
Yeah.
They think we're so stupid and we've become so
pathetic. We're all going to buy that
one. They are underfunding every public service and then telling us that the problem is something else.
Mate,
and it's got to,
if the money was there, then the people who have the skills would be able to do their job and cope with whatever influx, because we'd have the money, we'd have the resources, we'd have the space.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But the money's not there. Like you say, don't treat us like we're fucking idiots.
It's going to get worse.
And it's good that you broadcast all of those protests. And like you say, if you're not a part of it, then you're part of the problem. And I really agree with that. And you know what will happen with every protest? There'll be some prick popping up on our timelines on Twitter. If you're that white English guy who says, what about the March for White Englishmen?
Oh,
what
God.
About us? What about... Let me tell you about you, yeah? You're fine. You're going to be fine. Like, it's all going to work out. It's going to be absolutely okay.
What about the March for the Orange Men with pudgy fingers? Let's talk about desserts.
Well, I've got a top three dessert list that never really changes. It's just the positions change within that gold, silver, and bronze medal table. And it's two of them are meringue-based. And I know that you shouldn't have two meringue-based desserts in there.
Pavlova, you're going to say.
I love pavlova. Ooh, I love pavlova. Lemon meringue pie.
So oh, guys, pavlova.
Pavlova is the one,
fucking love
mate.
Both. And then the other one is banoffee pie.
Oh.
Banoffee pie is my shit.
That is the don. It's
about bread and butter pudding, though.
Yeah, I'm not really a fan.
Do you know what? I like, guys, creme brulee though. Come on.
Creme brulee is banging.
That is the absolute lick.
My missus made a rhubarb crumble the other day. Rhubarb crumble, anyone?
So that mixture of bitter and... Tyre is saying cheesecake all day.
Cheesecake all day. Producer Tyre is saying cheesecake all day.
But cheesecake has to be made by some dons. You can't get cheap cheesecake.
At least two of these...
Whereas I would eat a cheap lemon meringue pie. Like, no drama. I would stand and eat a cheap one. No drama. I would just eat that, bro.
So you just do any lemon meringue.
Yeah, I'm cash,
Tesco's,
bro.
Tesco's. Not even Tesco's finest.
I don't give a shit, bro.
Just Tesco's own brand lemon meringue.
I don't give a fucking shit. But a cheesecake needs to be
so
classy.
So if you ever have a falling out with Doc Brown or there's some sort of super fan, you know just start sending
just
budget
Tesco's
budgets,
own brand.
Tesco's own brand.
Oh, shit.
Lemon meringue. All right, so what's your metaphorical dessert?
Yeah, where are we at with dessert? Let's have a lightness.
Well... Okay, I sat down. It's a big decision, I think. If you're in a relationship, it's a big decision to sit down with your missus and say, this is the new series we're going to get into.
<That's so true.
laughs> On a number of levels. The first one being, and I really apologize to all my all our female listeners, but like, you've got a thing where you're not in the mood sometimes to watch the program. Like, if we've said this is our series, it'd be really useful to actually watch the fucking series. Like, sit down and watch it with me. And if you're not in the mood,
if
you're not in the mood, do I have to wait until like a month until you're in the mood to watch the third episode in the second season of some really exciting series?
Totally.
Please, once we've made the pact, let's watch it together. If you're not going to be in the mood, let me watch it on my fucking own.
Doc Brown, is there something you want to say about your relationship at this point?
Particular series we're talking about, Doc Brown.
But anyway,
quite cathartic.
Anyway. No, it's nothing to do with my wife. That was just all about the women
it's
of
totally
the world.
Very
general comment. Now, we settled down and we'd made our choice. We'd finished something good and we were trying to make up our mind on the next thing. We chose a show called The OA on Netflix.
It. I've watched all of that.
So I got about half an hour in and this humorless pompous,
oh, harsh,
pretentious pile of lost series 20 dick sucking bullshit has the nerve on 43 minutes
to drop the title,
to drop
sequence.
The opening credits, like,
amazing.
That's right, bitch, we are here, we are here. And I was like, fuck you, fuck you, this show makes no sense. It's got so much self-importance. It's got a ridiculous budget that you've wasted on everything except script writing. And I'm fucking done. I'm done. And I spoke to a couple people, and you know what they said? Oh, no, you'll get really into it, like towards the end of the season. I've had that chat before on other series where they go, yeah, but wait till season 3. How much time have you got in your fucking life?
Wait till 5 years in, it really picks up.
I've got shit to do, bruv. I'm done. I was done within 25 minutes, but when I saw that 43rd minute opening credits, I was like, screw everybody to do with this.
You read Difficult Men, Brett Scott. It's all about the showrunners, people like David Chase,
okay,
who did Sopranos, and David Simon, who did The Wire. The Wire, have you watched The Wire?
Yes.
Right, so kind of sucked until like season 3. Maybe 4.
I don't agree with that at all, but
I totally
continue.
Disagree. Okay.
It got a lot better, though. Banging. Anyway, everyone slept on it until season 3 or 4.
I can't believe he's just said the first 2 seasons of The Wire were
everyone
okay.
Slept on it.
You're going to get so much
basically,
hate on Twitter.
The Guardian didn't review it until season 4, so no one cared.
Oh,
anyway,
my
at
God,
that
Hayden.
Point, wow. At that point, wow. At that point,
just to say, our producer Ty is literally like physically doing stuff. I only see him doing when Arsenal are losing. Like, it's terrifying.
He's in pain.
Listen, my point is that, like, I think a lot of these shows that you're talking about, like OA, like, don't get me wrong, I liked all of The Wire. I'm just saying, like, it didn't pick up generally.
Oh, did you? You did.
Until season
that's a generally
four.
Accepted
so a lot of
opinion.
These shows are kind of living off the coattails of series like The Wire and The Sopranos. And all of these shows got given so much sort of free room to kind of, you know, do what they wanted to do, be really surreal, go in like alternative directions that no one expected. And they're kind of taking advantage of it.
Here's my dessert sort of question or topic. Really, based on that experience of the OA and based on my experience of a lot of television dramas over the past 5 or 6 years, yeah? If you're going to put a drama on TV, of a serial, how about you write the whole fucking thing before you start filming? It says, look, I'm just going to throw that out there because I'm seeing too many shows where it's so obvious that they've only written the first couple episodes,
yeah,
but they're filming already. It's gone into production. Now, as somebody who works in that business, I logistically, just to start with,
mental.
That's a nightmare.
That was like because Lost. Remember in Lost when everyone was like, what's going to happen? What have the writers
got
in store
knew.
For us?
Nobody
no one had fucking
knew.
Written it.
Now, don't get me wrong. You can get lucky. The Brer from who wrote Breaking Bad has publicly said he didn't know where it was going. He even said he wrote that scene, that sort of future scene where he opens the boot and he's got the gun and he was just like, let's just shoot that. I don't really know what it means.
I know, that's
but I'll work
crazy.
It out. Which is super crazy and brave of him to tell the truth about it.
Yeah.
And I respect him. But if you watch Better Call Saul, you know exactly the class of this guy because Better Call Saul is a mess. It's a mess.
It is.
So I think he got lucky with Breaking Bad.
He had a really good writer's room.
Like I say, I work in the business. So I don't want to diss individuals or anything like that because I need to get paid just like everybody else. But like
apart from on the OA, Doc Brown will not work
behalf,
on
I'm
series
not,
2
I'm not
of
fucking
the OA.
With OA at all. On behalf of the people who work tirelessly behind closed doors in production, how can you say we might film in this city or we might film in this city or we might film an exterior or we might film an interior? They need to know where they're going to set stuff up. They need to get locations sorted. They need to get permits from the council. They need to know if they can light this fucking place like to the right level. If you've got everything written and signed off, you can spend all your time and money making every single one of those scenes resonate with an audience.
So
rather than treat us like wankers
by that
by going
by that logic,
what's gonna happen
by that logic by that logic, two questions. Do you A, love Game of Thrones?
Because I've never seen it.
What are you talking about, Doc Brown?
No intention of ever watching it.
Mate, what are you on about?
Just no interest.
Bro.
No interest, bro. I don't do dwarves.
He's one of these lot.
I don't do Lord of the Rings.
I'm so bored of this chat.
Any of that.
It's not about that, fam.
I was going to ask him what character he'd play in it if he was asked.
Bro, I don't know anything about it.
Don't give me all this. It's got hobbits in it.
It has,
right? That is so ignorant.
Has it or has it not got hobbits?
That's the Hobbit.
Mate, I think that's quite prejudiced of you, actually.
Yeah, that's well prejudiced. That's almost worse.
There's Hobbit.
Listen, I just want to say, all Game of Thrones fans, right?
To all our Hobbit listeners out there.
Listen, but not
some
just
of
that,
my best friends are Hobbits.
Going back to the point you're making about the shows, I think it is really, really clear that there was a period of time in Hollywood, and my understanding is that after the writer's strike, essentially, mid-range movies, the sort of between 12 million and 4 million, it just disappeared from Hollywood. You get the massive films and the little films, and that started going into these long serialized shows, which is amazing for a lot of box set binging. But I don't know if anyone saw Bloodline on Netflix.
Bruv, I'm watching it right now.
So sick. Well, I'm just going to tell you. Are you in the first series?
I'm literally on episode 5. So right.
This is really annoying that I can't say that.
Please,
anyone who
please,
knows,
just close his ears.
Just all I'm saying is, because this is what you'll find in a lot of series, is that it used to be that you'd have in the UK, you generally make a series of 6, and you have to go very, very deeply into kind of like a story arc for how that series is going to culminate and what point it's going to end on. In American series now of 10, episode 9 is basically the end, and episode 10 is the reset button so that they can just start again with the new series. And a lot of stories don't need that. A lot of stories need to end because that is the point. And ultimately, if you're watching, did you watch Westworld?
No.
I mean, Jesus Christ. I mean, anyone who's seen Westworld will know that, like, there is a very good argument for ending that series in one series. And you know what? Fawlty Towers, right? That show ended after 2 series because they knew they'd done everything they could do that was brilliant. It would not ever happen like that now.
Fawlty Towers is the goat. Fawlty Towers is the goat. I think there's certain.
It's the goat.
I think there's certain approaches that I think are very mature. I think the approach to True Detective was very mature.
Yeah,
I think their hands perhaps were kind of forced by what they were trying to do was get mega stars.
Yeah.
Right. Movie stars in the lead roles.
In order
to do that, they had to limit the run.
No, do you know how that works? True Detective. What happened with that is the production company that made it brought Matthew McConaughey and
because they're execs on it, right?
Yeah, they brought
Woody
them
Harrelson.
On and Woody Harrelson. They brought them on first, and they produced it, like you're saying, and then they made the entire thing. I think it made the entire first episode, and then sold it to HBO. Was it HBO?
It was HBO. Yeah.
Sold it to HBO. In its entirety, and they even got a deal where they picked up all the points on it for DVD sales or anything
that's
like
it.
That. HBO made almost nothing off that show.
That's amazing.
It was a whole new way of.
But in a way, it's
TV
totally
series.
What Doc's saying, which is that
I just want focus. I want people
exactly.
to be focused.
But it's also it undermines storytelling.
It really
does. Anyone who's studied screenwriting knows that, like, that, you know, the old days of the kind of like the one-off film. I'll tell you what, a brilliant film I watched recently, Midnight Special. Did you see that film? Beautiful, singular vision drama that completes at the end of the film. Now, if that was in a serialized world, right, the idea that story, it would become revolting to watch the narratives and the characters fall apart.
And it's happening all the time, bro.
Exactly.
It's happening all the time. What people are trying to replicate is what Fargo's been able to do with their TV series. But what no one else seems to clock is that what Fargo did was they took the essence of the movie.
Yeah.
They took the vibe of the Fargo movie, just the vibe of it, and just tried to create something within that world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? They didn't say, well, the story of the movie is classic. Like Westworld, the story of the movie is classic. Westworld's a great movie. But you can't take 90 minute story and stretch it. It just doesn't work.
They're doing it all
like
the time
that.
Now. They're talking about the story world. You know, Snatch, Crackle have just done Snatch.
No,
that's
coming
out.
That's going to be a nightmare.
Well, I mean, one of my boys is in that, so I'm not going to, like, Luca, I'm sure it's going to be absolutely killer.
He'll be amazing.
He is sick in it. Trust me, he's deep.
I think of being a bit down in this stuff, I can see something in, you know, Hamlet, The Reckoning. A Tale of Two
Cities.
What's going to happen? A Tale of Two Cities 2.
Two Cities 2. That's
years.
Yeah, look, we could, you know, you need to have sequels.
This what are the best box sets you've watched
which
recently?
Which are the
then?
Third four?
Fast and the Furious 7-7.
Yeah. For me, the goat of box sets is The Sopranos. But I think Sopranos ushered in the
style. I never got tired.
This era.
How many series of The Sopranos?
Well, actually, series 5 I didn't like.
I agree.
I thought it dropped off.
Yeah.
And but still, four series.
I totally excused it.
You're into it for four series.
Yeah. I totally excused it because it's Sopranos. But I think that ushered in this golden age of television that we're seeing now.
West
and
Wing.
Don't get me wrong, as much as I'm cussing these shows, like, it is, there's never been a better time in the history of television than now.
So you're saying you can have these long series?
Yeah, they can exist.
They
all
just
these
need
crap
to be
ones can
really
exist.
Good
because
rooms,
there's,
lo-
yeah,
really good writers.
There's loads of good stuff. And, you know, like, I know for a fact that there is a push to find the best writers, to find better writers than there are now. There's to find the next generation of writers.
But you know,
there's no
difficult
barrier for young writers such as myself.
Well, that's
there really
not, I
isn't.
Don't know about that, mate. Because the difference is now is
they want content,
bro. But if you work in the BBC, if you're starting out in the UK, generally what happens if you've never worked in TV is you'll get enough money to write a script or to develop.
Oh yeah,
a project.
No, not a lot of people
America
are paying
now,
to develop.
Exactly. In America
that's
now,
the
they
difference.
Expect you to come with a whole script for episode one and an outline for 10 episodes. That is a lot of work.
Sorry, I should have been very, you know, very clear.
Just because you're famous
when I say,
now.
No, I should have been very, very clear. When I say there's no barrier for me, there isn't, but there's also no money for me. I've been paid to develop one script, and every single day I get an email from a production company or a directly from the TV network saying, can you deliver something?
Yeah.
And I say, yes, for how much? Well,
nothing.
We'll see what you deliver.
No, it's,
I know.
It's bullshit.
Like I can just fly off a script
liberty
in 5 minutes.
Well,
it's
this
so
is
true.
Why, Doc Brown, you should be more interested in going to LA because there is a genuine industry there.
Oh, yeah, no question.
No, but we're talking about LA. In LA,
so
you have to deliver.
You're paid by a British channel, or
no, I've been paid once for development of a script.
By a British channel?
By a British production company.
British production company.
Via a mainstream.
But this is the thing, in LA they develop stuff all the time and they pay at the very front. You know, friends of mine have written like 4 or 5 pilot scripts for sitcoms
that is
that never got produced.
And what's
and they make
even
a bunch
more attractive
of money
is
yeah,
I can write here
it's
and
different.
Just email it.
It's different. It's different now because things with like Amazon and Netflix are different to the traditional broadcasters and they're the gold standard now, right? Because
no,
like CBS and stuff, they don't have the money to do that.
It's also just the levels and you know the risks that broadcasters in whatever shape or form, whether it's Amazon or HBO, are prepared to take in America. Have you seen Atlanta, the Donald Glover series?
I've seen episode one and then my catch up thing stopped working.
If anyone knows how
I can get the rest of it, because I loved what I saw.
You should keep watching because it gets more and more surreal. It goes to some weird
places. I've got
places.
A lot of time for Donald Glover.
But it's so brave. You would never ever get something like that away on a British broadcast.
Yeah.
I bumped, here's my little celeb story to round things off. I bumped into my one of my old friends who was a rapper called Riz Ahmed, who's now one of the biggest stars in the world.
Night Of, unbelievable.
Oh yeah, absolutely superb, The Night Of. In fact, that was the last show me and my missus watched.
That was
we loved
incredible.
It. I bumped into him and he was going Nando's with Donald Glover.
Amazing.
Right?
Amazing.
And I was like, I swear that's Donald Glover. And I see Riz, what's going on? And he was like, hey, what's going on? He's like, this is Donald. This is Donald. And I was like, hey, bruv, seriously, hey, I'm a big fan. You know, stand up. Your comedy, your rap, your acting.
Yeah.
And I told him, like, we joked around because like we both went for the part of Young Lando.
No.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. And obviously he pit me. But
what is he, Young Lando, going to Calrissian?
Yeah.
No fucking way.
You must
way.
Have heard about that.
I didn't know that. Okay. I'm a massive Star Wars fan as well.
And then. And he goes, oh, thanks a lot, bro. Like, what's your name? And Riz goes to him, he's the UKU. Well, that's the biggest compliment.
That is a huge compliment. Just quickly, before we wrap it up, recommendations for box sets, what are you watching that's good at the minute?
I watch Atlanta for sure. That's the one that I'm watching right now.
I will
now.
Definitely do that.
All right. What about you? What are you watching?
Bloodline. I'm watching Bloodline and I'm loving it.
I'm absolutely loving Billions at the minute.
Yeah.
If you haven't watched it, Paul Giamatti is
he's
just
in everything.
But I mean, he is great in everything. But something about him and Damian Lewis together blow my mind.
That's Damian Lewis, isn't
Yeah. So, dude, have you got anything coming up that you want to tell our audience about?
Actually, I'm really excited to announce that I've completed, just finished mixing and mastering my comeback album, an album of 12 very special songs to me. No Comedy features Michael Payne and Example and Andy Burrows of Razorlight, amongst others. it's a very, very special project, and I'm going to do a little mini tour to celebrate, starting on the 22nd of March, if this comes out before then. So you can have a look at the dates at docbrown.co.uk. And unbelievably, this is the nature of my life. In amongst my return to rap tour, I'm also opening for Ricky on his Humanity stand-up tour. So
unbelievable.
I'm going to have to switch my head.
Opening for Mr. Gervais.
Yeah. So wow. It's going to be a bit mad. But that's basically the bulk of the spring for me.
Mate.
And then during the days, I'm going to be shooting a movie for David Walliams, one of his kids' books.
Amazing.
A book called Rap Burger. So I'm quite excited about that too.
Well, listen, remains for us to say thank you so much. It's been so fun talking to you. It's been such a pleasure. So thank you so much,
pleasure.
Mr. Brown.
Cheers.
Hayden, look after yourself. See you next week at some point.
Yeah.
And, audience, peace out.
Yeah.